Welcome to The Deep Dive, powered by the Security Nexus.
Glad to be here.
We're a Maryland-based national security consultancy. We specialize in strategic advisory, education, and public engagement.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission is really to inform, educate, and empower. We want to give professionals and the public clear, accessible, actionable knowledge.
That's right. Especially on complex topics.
Exactly. So if you're looking for insight into, you know, cyber threats, hybrid warfare, strategic security policy, check us out, thesecuritynexus.net.
Good resource.
Today, we're taking a deep dive into something that, well, it touches almost everything. Technology, everyday products.
Pretty much every field.
Yeah. We're calling it the bureaucracy of secrecy. Is classification hindering innovation?
And that title might sound a bit dramatic, maybe, but the secrecy we're talking about isn't like classified documents.
No, not spies and stuff. It's more subtle.
Mm.
It's about how the systems we use to categorize things, often invisibly, can end up creating these rigid walls.
Right. Walls that slow down progress, stifle new ideas, and really impact agility. That's what we want to unpack today.
We'll look at academic research, sure, but also some really interesting real-world examples. We got a stack of sources to pull from.
Yeah, some good ones. Mario Coccia on innovation classification itself.
Gustavo Dembski Gomes de Carvalho and his co-authors on measuring innovation.
Daniel Sage and his team on what they call classification work. Fascinating stuff from construction.
And Arif Bijaksana and others looking at digital transformation in classification society. So, quite a range.
Definitely.
Okay, let's kick things off with section one, the inherently complex and often inconsistent world of classification.
Right. You'd think defining innovation would be pretty straightforward.
You would.
Yeah.
But apparently not. Mario Coccia, back in his 2006 paper, points out researchers have been wrestling with this for decades. How do you define it, explain it, measure it?
And he says classification is key, but it's two things at once. It's the process of sorting.
How we organize things.
And it's the output, the structured knowledge you get.
Okay, but here's the kicker.
This is where it gets messy.
Yeah.
Despite being so fundamental, Coccia says it often leads to, and I'm quoting here, a diverse range of interpretations and frequent misuse of classification terms.
Why? It's too many variables.
Seems like it. Too many factors in technical change. He even draws a line between taxonomy, which is about maximizing the differences between groups with clear rules,
okay,
and classification, which is often more about just arranging groups, maybe in a very detailed, disaggregated way.
So different approaches even within the idea of classifying.
Yeah.
Which I guess leads to the next problem, the name game.
Exactly. If everyone's using different terms or the same term differently, how do you even talk about it coherently?
Rosanna Garcia and Roger Calentone really dug into this in 2002.
They did. Their paper highlighted, quote, a plethora of definitions for innovation types, just tons of them.
Leading to ambiguity.
Total ambiguity in how terms like innovation and innovativeness are used. Think about words like radical, really new, incremental, discontinuous.
We hear those all the time.
All the time. But Garcia and Calentone found they're used without consistent definitions, which leads to incongruent categorizations, and I like this phrase, research myopia.
Yeah.
Basically, researchers can't see the bigger picture because the labels are all over the place.
Wow. Do they give examples?
Oh, yeah. Great ones. Think about the electric typewriter. Seems simple enough.
Okay, like the IBM Selectric?
Maybe. So someone like Utterback might call it radical innovation. Why? Because it disrupted the industry, right? Changed things.
Makes sense.
But then Rothwell and Gardner might look at it and say, no, that's just an incremental innovation. It's just an improvement on the old manual typewriter.
Ah, okay. Different perspective.
Totally. And Kleinschmidt and Cooper might call it moderate. Abernathy and Clark, maybe revolutionary. Same typewriter, four different labels.
That's confusing.
It is. And it wasn't just the typewriter. They mentioned the Canon laser photocopier, too. New digital tech.
Right. Big deal at the time.
Huge. So Utterback, probably radical. Rothwell and Gardner, maybe incremental because it just changed to subassembly. Kleinschmidt and Cooper, moderate. Abernathy and Clark, just a regular innovation.
So the takeaway is, this isn't just semantics.
Not at all. This inconsistent labeling seriously messes things up. It hinders academic progress, makes it impossible to compare studies effectively. It's like everyone's building with different sized bricks, you know?
Yeah, you can't build anything solid that way.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a perfect setup for the next part. When classification itself becomes a bureaucracy of barriers.
Right. This is where the work of Daniel Sage, Chloe Vitry, Andrew Dainty, and Sarah Barnard comes in. Their 2021 paper introduces this really powerful idea of classification work.
Classification work? What does that mean?
They describe it as this invisible socio-material infrastructure that silently shapes our worlds. It's the background stuff.
Invisible infrastructure.
Okay. Like, it could be informal things, like little rules of thumb people use, or it could be highly standardized tests and protocols. The point is, it's often completely unnoticed.
until
it breaks, or rather, until something doesn't fit the classification. When the system fails on something new, suddenly you see how powerful and sometimes how restrictive that invisible structure really is.
That's really interesting. It becomes a hidden barrier. You can probably think of examples in your own work, right?
Yeah.
Unspoken rules, categories that just limit things.
Absolutely. And Sage and his colleagues provide this fantastic case study. It's from the UK housing market involving something called large format block work, LFB.
LFB. Okay, what is it?
It's basically a big concrete block, story height, 600 millimeter wide, made of aerated concrete, apparently common in Europe, but it was new to the UK.
And the benefit?
Huge potential benefit, designed to cut construction times way down, reduce the need for skilled bricklayers. Sounds great, right?
Sounds like a game changer. Should fly off the shelves.
You'd think. But then came Vignette 1. The masonry code hurdle.
Ah, the classification strikes.
Exactly. Even though it's made of masonry, this LFB block was just bigger. It was larger than what is technically classified as a block under the existing UK masonry code.
Seriously? Just because it was too big?
Yep. And that simple fact meant, quote, it can't use the masonry code to design it.
Wow. So what happened?
Well, the consequences were pretty severe. Because it didn't fit the code, the LFB had to be treated as an experimental structural element.
Experimental. That sounds expensive.
It was. It meant extra individual checks on designs and sites by this warranty co. Made the whole thing costly and time-consuming. Widespread adoption became very difficult.
Just because of a definition in a code book.
Yeah.
That perfectly shows how classification can kill agility.
It really does. And they had to jump through hoops to fix it. This process called scooping.
Scoping.
Yeah. Bringing in new actors, as they put it. Mm. Things like independent reports, tons of testing, even digital imaging techniques. All just to prove that this big block could actually fit the existing masonry design approach.
Trying to make it fit the old box.
Essentially, yeah. The goal was normalization. Trying to make the system treat it as normal as possible without having to put a lot of manpower into checking the checkers. Reduce the friction.
But wait, there's a vignette too? So it wasn't smooth sailing even after the scoping?
Not quite. Even with all the lab tests saying the block itself was fine, a new problem emerged. Site workmanship.
Ah, the human element.
Always. You know how careful they were with the forming of the joint? That real-world variability, the messiness of construction sites, it kind of disrupted the clean classification they got from the lab.
So how do they handle that? More tests?
They needed a different kind of transformation. They created a system manual.
A manual?
Yeah. Think of it as another layer of classification. This manual formally classified what counted as acceptable site workmanship. They even used photographic interpretations of workmanship. Pictures showing good joint, bad joint.
That's fascinating. They built a new classification around the messiness.
Precisely. And this leads to a really counterintuitive finding from their research.
Yeah.
Sometimes innovation adoption, getting something widely used, happens not despite the weaknesses and uncertainties, but because of them. By enrolling actors because of and not despite their weakness and mutability.
Wait, run that by me again. Enrolling actors because of their weakness.
Yeah, it sounds weird. But what they mean is you can't always rely on just the hard, clean data, the less controvertible arguments from the huge and efficient laboratories.
The perfect lab results.
Right. Sometimes, to make innovation work in the real world, you have to embrace the ambiguity, the more controvertible arguments, the stuff happening in the small and inefficient laboratories, like a building site.
So you need classifications that acknowledge the real-world imperfections.
Exactly. It's about adapting the system to fit reality, not just forcing reality to fit the system's neat boxes. Sometimes the messy path is the only way forward.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. Which brings us nicely to our third section. Measuring innovation and addressing resistance to change.
Because if we want to manage innovation, understand it, maybe even steer it, we need ways to measure it first.
And that's where Gustavo Dembski Gomes de Carvalho and his colleagues come in. Their 2017 review looked at innovativeness measures. What did they find?
They basically found measures fall into three main buckets. First, you've got inputs.
Like R&D spending?
Patents. Exactly. Money in, ideas documented. Second, there are capabilities or processes.
More like the company culture, leadership style, how they work.
Spot on, the internal engine. And third, you have outputs.
The results, new products, revenue from those products.
Yep, the tangible outcomes, inputs, capabilities, outputs.
They didn't just categorize the measures, right? Yeah. They used that to categorize organizations.
They did. They proposed classifying organizations based on whether they actually have those inputs, capabilities, and outputs. So you could be, say, an immature non-innovator.
Doesn't sound good.
Or maybe an innovator by chance, just lucked into something.
Huh. I like that one.
Or, ideally, a mature innovator who has all three elements firing. It tries to add some nuance beyond just innovative or not innovative.
Okay, so that's one way to measure and classify. What about Mario Cochi again? He had another idea, right? The seismic scale.
Yeah, this is really cool. Back in that 2006 paper, he proposed thinking about innovation intensity like earthquakes on the Richter scale.
Okay, how does that work?
He created this meta taxonomy, pulling together different innovation types into 7 innovation degrees based purely on their economic impact.
So a small innovation is like a minor tremor.
Right, and a massive one is like the big one.
What's the top of the scale? A 7-degree.
Exactly, a 7-degree innovation. He gives examples like the steam engine or the World Wide Web. These represent a fundamental change of techno-economic paradigm.
Paradigm shift.
Totally. Revolutionary changes that just alter everything. Human communication, how we live, how firms are structured, entire markets get reshaped.
Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of innovations that definitely break existing classifications. You need whole new ways to think about things after something like the internet comes along.
Absolutely. They shatter the old bureaucracy of secrecy, you could say.
Yeah.
But that brings up a really important point. What happens when the systems themselves resist change?
Yeah, the classifications, the organizations built around them, they don't always welcome disruption, do they?
Not usually, no. And Arif Bijaksana and his colleagues highlighted this directly in their 2024 research on classification societies undergoing digital transformation.
What was the big hurdle they found?
A very human one. Resistance to change from stakeholders within classification societies. The people inside the system pushing back.
Makes sense. People get comfortable. Systems get entrenched.
Definitely. And Bijaksana and the team stress that overcoming this isn't just about having better tech. It requires a concerted effort.
Like what?
Engaging those stakeholders, really communicating why the changes are needed, involving them in the decisions, building trust.
So it's about culture change, not just process change.
Exactly. Creating a culture that actually embraces change, that sees innovation as necessary, not threatening, that's crucial for staying agile.
Okay, so let's try to wrap this up. We've covered a lot of ground.
We have. I think the main thread is that classification, while we absolutely need it to organize things, can easily become this sort of invisible bureaucracy.
Yeah, it's not intentionally secret, but its effects are hidden.
Yeah.
It can make thinking rigid, slow down new technologies.
Like with that LFB building block example.
Right. And create these unnecessary hurdles just because something doesn't fit neatly into an old box. The secrecy is really the unnoticed power these classifications have.
And recognizing that power, understanding this dynamic, often messy classification work can actually be super useful for you, the listener.
How so?
Well, if you see what looks like over-compartmentalization or a lack of agility somewhere maybe in your industry, your organization, policy discussions.
Could be cybersecurity, product development, anything.
Anything. It might not just be inefficiency. It could be the silent force of these classification systems at play.
So the aha moment comes when you start asking how things are being classified.
Exactly. How is it classified? And crucially, what purpose does that classification serve? What does it enable? And what does it maybe prevent?
Asking those questions helps you see the framework itself.
Right. And seeing the framework empowers you to critique it, to question it, and maybe push for ways to make it more fluid, more adaptable, better suited for innovation.
Okay, so here's a final thought to leave everyone with. A provocative question, maybe?
Go for it.
Think about your own world, your daily work, your industry. What invisible classification systems might be operating there, silently shaping progress, or maybe holding it back?
And if you could reevaluate those systems, those categories, what unforeseen potential might you unlock for innovation, for collaboration?
Something to chew on.
Definitely.
For more deep dives like this one, exploring strategic security policy, the changing threat landscape, and more, please do visit us online.
TheSecurityNexus.net.
That's the place. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.